This is an interview with Cyril Vrabel for the Youngstown State University Oral History Program by Doug Sulhanik at Mr. Vrabel's home on Tuesday, April 23rd, 1985 at 7:30 p.m. Okay. Tell me something about your parents and family and what you remember most about them.
Well, my family came from the central part of Pennsylvania. My dad was a coal miner from a very early age, and he came up with a family of 12 children, and was in a coal mine at the age of 14, and through many strikes and a few explosions in the mine, and then he decided to come to Bessemer in 1923, and worked in a cement plant and reared his family here in Bessemer. Had, three boys and three girls, and spent all his working days in the cement plant, plus myself and two brothers retired from the cement plant, I must say, and that was the livelihood of my dad, and through some hard times too during the Depression and in the 30s, and it was pretty tough with six kids.
Were they immigrants?
My mother was. She came over just when she was like 3 or 4 years old. And my dad was born in Clearfield County.
Okay, what was school like? What do you remember about school, grade school or high school, coming up through Bessemer?
Well, I started school in Bessemer. I started in, I was 5 years old when I started, and we lived up on First Street. And, it was an experience coming into Bessemer and seeing the school, the grade school as it was then, but it's been tore down, and the fire department has their building there now. You probably remember
that.
But,
yeah.
And, it was a good experience. There was a gravel pit out in front. Instead of a lawn, they had all limestone. Then we played football on it and baseball, and I mean, it was a lot of black and blue marks, you know, and
yeah.
Torn clothes. And it was very interesting. I enjoyed it, and had some good teachers, and old-time teachers, I must say. They lasted for probably 30, 40 years in that school. And I know when I graduated, the ones that taught me were still there, you know. And high school was very interesting, too. Well, it was just right in the time of the war, you know, pre-war days. I graduated in 1941, and you know what happened in 1941. And the excitement was, you know, the Army or Navy or whatever. It was to look forward to. That was about it. But I did get a job before I went into the Army. I worked for about a year and a half in a cement plant. Then I enlisted in the Air Corps.
What about, what do you remember with the Depression? Was it particularly hard growing up in a small town through the Depression?
Well, now, looking back, Doug, I can see what my family went through, my mother and dad went through, you know. At that time, I couldn't realize too much. I know I had to go and get the run across the field at the Hulitz's farm and bring skim milk home, which he gave us for nothing. And we raised chickens and a few hogs, and I had to go up there and carry straw for bedding home, and then there was a program here in town that they gave surplus food, which it's reoccurring now. And we used to get rice and canned beef, and the most I remember there, the is I had a, we got milk. There was a milk program, and we got a pint of milk for each kid, you know, for each child in the family every day. We had to drink it at school. And then for the weekend, we got that pint of milk for everybody. We had to pick it up for Saturday and Sunday. And I used to have to go with a little wagon up there and pick all the milk up for the family. And I know people used to say, here comes the milkman, you know. And well, we survived. And there was a clothing program. We got those old-fashioned knickers and the long socks and the winter underwear. We got that from the more or less county, you know, and the state aid. So it's coming right back to that now, it seems. The
same type of thing.
Surplus food and the tax rebates for the elderly and the fuel rebates for the elderly. Program on the pharmaceuticals for the elderly. So I mean, it seems like history is repeating itself. Mm-hmm. But it was hard. We had a good time, though. There was no automobiles as such. I used to run from in the morning to school, come home for lunch, and maybe get a little bowl of soup and run back up there and run home. I used to put those four trips a day, every day. We tried to take a different route all the time. One time we'd go back by Smithsfield, another time the tracks, you
something
know.
Something different.
Something different, yeah.
What do you remember about the town? What sticks out in your mind growing up or during the Depression about Bessemer?
Well,
or the people?
I think maybe my friends then. It was more close-knit then. You went, like you told me, you played in the field down here. But I think we were a little closer than maybe you and Terry and the other kids were then, because there was no distraction. I mean, you had the friends, and there was just a nucleus there that you depended on, and you played with, and you lived with. I think it was a lot closer than it.
What was a good time? What would you say would be a good time?
A good time was going up to the field there and playing baseball and playing football in the fall and winter sports, sled riding, and maybe going up to the dam or the lake with an old pair of ice skates and building a fire. And yeah. That was a good time there.
So like you said before, there weren't any distractions. There wasn't anything else to, not that there wasn't anything else to do, but that was...
Well, you found things to do. I mean, you...
Centered around town, though.
Yeah, just in town, yeah. We never went out that much.
When did you first realize that America was going to go to war? Either Europe or Japan?
Well, like I say, I graduated in 1941. Well, I'd say in reading current events and our... POD prof was very strict on maybe us reading Life magazine and Time, which was in current events was a thing with him, you know. And with probably in about 1940, well, we could see maybe a buildup of some storm clouds coming up, you know, on the horizon.
How about for you? You know, what was the mood of the country like at that, or the mood of the town, more like it, when war broke out?
Well, I think it was, everyone was for going in and helping preserve our way of life, you know, and that there was no conscientious objectors, like you would say, like during the Vietnam War, protesters and that. I mean, it was just the direct opposite. I mean, everyone seemed to say, all right, let's get going and get a job done, you know, get it going. And we had quite a few from Bessemer in the armed forces.
Why do you think that was that way? Was there, do you think that people felt that there was a particular threat?
I would say yes, but I don't know how to put this. As far as the media was concerned, I mean, I don't think it was like now where you knew everything that was really happening, you know, You get news today, the second after it happens, it's on the TV or that. I think it was a lot of political motivation then. I know when the president would come on, I mean, everyone would drop everything, you know, and they listen to President Roosevelt, you know, and I mean, they took him for his word 100%, you know. And he asked for help then, and I really think he got it.
You think he motivated?
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes. Uh-huh. Yes.
How about yourself then? What, when you personally knew you were going to go, was it the draft or?
I always had, when I was a little kid, I always had airplanes on my mind. And I wanted to get into some type of flying. I used to make model airplanes. I had scores of them and used to fly with that rubber band propeller and try to make them go. Well, I wanted to get into the flying end of the Army, and so I enlisted in the aviation cadet program. They more or less relaxed the qualifications at that time. Before 1940, and that you had to be a college graduate to get into the air cadet program. But they relaxed the standards, and they were taking anyone qualified physically and an aptitude test program too. So I got into that program.
Was that okay? You graduated in 1941. Was that been in the summer?
No, I was in. We've been in 1942. I enlisted in the reserve,
okay.
Air Corps Reserve, and then when they called me in 1943, in the spring of 43.
What was that like for you to leave home when you knew you were going?
Well, I more or less was looking forward to getting into that program, but I know the family was not reluctant, but they didn't want to see the boys go, you know, and I know my mother and dad had three sons, and eventually that they were all going to get in it, and I was the first. So I know I went down to Pittsburgh. I took my basic in Miami Beach. It was not a really nice thing then. Mm-hmm. And my mother and sister come down to Pittsburgh with me and, you know, waved goodbye and took a train down to Miami, and that was my induction into the Air Corps.
All right. What was that training like?
The training wasn't too bad. I went into basic training, just the fundamentals, you know. Well, you're in the Army, you know. But then it started getting a little bit more academic, I'd say. And after that, I went into what they call the college program, and I went into the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville, and I spent a year down there in college taking up meteorology, and mm-hmm. and I did some flying down there, basic flying, and it was mostly school.
Were they choosing something for you, or were you allowed to pick?
No. This was more or less a basic program for everybody, and then after that, I was into the flying end of it. We were being trained for, eventually for pilot training, and after we left the University of Arkansas, we went into San Antonio, Texas for pre-flight training, and...
When would this be then?
Spring of 43,
okay.
And went down there. I was in the cadets, the air cadets, and going in there and getting a GI haircut, you know, mm-hmm. almost bald and all, and went through a month or so there, training, and the physicals were out of this world, and I had a little bit of an eye problem, and they tested me. I think I took 4 days, just eye exams, and they decided that I couldn't go any further on the eye exam. I couldn't correct it. I had, I think what they call it, it's a foyer. It is a more or less I would probably see double, you know, at altitude and when the oxygen was less, you know, flying. So I got washed out, what they say.
Were you disappointed at that?
Yes, I was. I it broke my heart because eventually the class that I was in graduated the P-51 pilots, and I'd have given my right arm for that, you know. And but I washed out and I went into a program of communications. Then I got back into flying again.
You still wanted to get back in?
I wanted to get back in. I took some more exams. I went into pressure chambers to prove that my eyes weren't bad and all this and that. I went into these decompression chambers maybe 5-6 different times to altitudes of maybe 40,000-50,000 feet equivalent. And I passed it pretty good. And came out of that and I had a couple of interviews and a couple more tests. Aptitude test, and he said, "We're going to put you back on flying." I said, "In what way?" He said, "Well, we're going to send you to communication school, and then we're going to send you to gunnery school." So I went to communication school. I was a radio operator.
Where was that at?
At Sioux Falls Army Air Base, South Dakota. And then they shipped me down to Yuma, Arizona to took some gunnery, and I was a radio operator gunner in a B-17. So, so I was back in flying again, Doug.
Okay, now we're at the end of 43 now. Are we in a fall yet?
Yeah, we're going into the fall and maybe the first part of 44 now.
Okay, now where are you thinking now? What is there one way or another you're thinking? Maybe you're going to Japan, or you're going to the Pacific, or you're going to
Well, there was no way of knowing then. But then once we got into more or less some overseas training, we almost figured out we were going to go into the ETO, B-17s.
Mm-hmm.
Then in after our gunnery school, I came home on a delay en route, 10-day delay en route, and I ended up in Salt Lake City, and then to Kearney, Nebraska, and then we were briefed on maybe flying over to England, and we were going to take some new ships over. But then something happened, and that fell through, and they put us on a train and shipped us from Kearney, Nebraska to New Jersey, and we took a boat over to England in 44.
Okay.
Summer.
All right. How about D-Day? Where are you at D-Day?
I'm D-Day. I'm still in the United States.
Okay. Was that a surprise to you? Did you pretty much know? Was the word out that we were going to invade?
Well, we knew there was something coming up because the way that they were, there was a massive exodus of people from the United States. You know,
yeah.
I mean the ports were filled, and we knew there was something coming up. But I went over right after D-Day. I was shipped overseas with our crew, and more or less we were replacements for the 8th Air Force. And we landed up in Scotland, and then I took some more training there, some more or less British blind landing and radio instructions again. And I was assigned to the 303rd Bomb Group in England, and started flying my missions there in July. And I had 30 missions. On our 30th mission, we had an accident and we were shot down over Germany.
What were most of those missions like? Were they all about the same?
No, there was some easy ones, and they're called milk runs. You know, you went in and we had some missions into Belgium and into the Ruhr Valley that weren't too bad then, but Later on, we start penetrating into Germany a little further, some Berlin, and into down toward the southern part of Germany, toward Munich then, and those are pretty rough.
What was it like the first time you went? Remember? First time you knew you were going on a mission that...
Well, I think it was a lot of just anxiety. I mean, it was... we wanted to go, but still yet, you know, there was a risk there, you know. And the first mission, I think, more or less I welcomed it, more or less get it under your hat, you know, and that was it. And being just a, what you'd call a greenhorn on it, and look, just keeping your mouth shut, you know, looking at the veterans, what they were saying. Then we became veterans. And
were you confident in what you could do? I mean, did you think you could, if under fire on that?
Oh, yeah, we had a good team. Okay. Oh, yeah, we had a real good team. I mean, that's what it took. I mean, in fact, we had a few, two of our crew members that they couldn't take it, and they more or less resigned. They were assigned to some other outfit, MPs or that. But we didn't want that weak link, you know what I mean? We wanted everyone to be strong. And we were young. Heck, I was just 20 years old, you know, and I think the pilot, he was in his late 20s, and he was the oldest guy on a plane. And we had a good team.
What were all the missions like, though? You said all the places that you went, were they the objective of the missions?
Well, we bombed steel, we bombed railroad yards, we bombed synthetic oil, we bombed transportation highways and ball bearing factories, more or less anything that was helping out the war effort in Germany, you know. Mm-hmm.
Before you had the accident, was there any mission that you really screwed up, that you guys really remembered that you just, or one that was particularly successful, one that you really...
Well, yes, we got presidential citation bombing Schweinfurt. That was the ball bearing factory. And I think they sent up, I don't know how many planes, but I think 164 bombers went down over that Schweinfurt factory. 10 men in a plane, and they probably were all lost. And that was a mission that I think I remembered. And I remember probably the last one was the most important one in my mind.
Tell me about that one.
We were flying to the I.J. Farben synthetic oil factories at Merseburg, that was down toward Munich, Merseburg, Germany, and this was our second mission in there. And it was, this is a mission that we were all just afraid of because of the first one. They had something like 700 or 800 anti-aircraft guns protecting this oil. And when we flew into that barrage, you'd look out maybe 10, 20 miles, and it'd send up a barrage maybe 500, 600 feet, maybe 1,000 feet thick, you know, just a big pillar of smoke. And you flew into it. And just prayed to God that you, one of those didn't have your name on. Yeah. But when we went in there, the second time, it was just really heavy, and there was a lot of fighters. And our wingman got hit by some anti-aircraft, some flak, and he more or less winged over and hit our plane, our wing. Mm-hmm. And we started going down. We lost a lot of altitude, and I don't know if God was with us that they could pull the plane out. It was hit pretty bad.
What were you thinking when it was going down? Were you working, or were you?
I was working just before that in more or less trying to get some bomb reports and that, you know, and after that, I don't know, my mind just went blank. I mean, it was just self-preservation after that. But they pulled the plane out, the pilot and co-pilot and the engineer pulled the plane out, and we were hit pretty bad. In fact, we lost formation, and we started gaining altitude. We had one engine out, and we were flying straight through Germany all alone. No escort. We called for escort, and there was four or five P-51s come in, and they were attacked by some FW-190s and Messerschmitts, and they took off, and that left us all alone, and they just blew us right out of the sky. And, we all bailed out.
Where were you when you bailed out?
Near Hanover, Germany. We made it almost halfway through. The other half wasn't too successful.
When you bailed out, were you all together?
No, it was two of us, me and the waste gunner. More or less, I bailed out to the waste, and he did too. And we landed, though, I'd say, within a half a mile of each other. And we bailed out at probably around 30,000 feet. And they got us, both of us, I know he, I saw him running, they captured him, and I spilled my chute and unhooked the harness, and I start running, and I heard some shots being fired, and I just raised my hand, and that was it.
What was that feeling like?
I'll tell you what, it was desolation. I was all alone. That's nobody's there to help me, and they took us up into a small village there, and I mean, we were showed off, you know, the home guard was showing us off, and some of the people showed compassion, and you know, there's a few women there, they brought some water to us, and I tried to leave my chute in the field, and they made me wrap it all up and carry it. I had to carry my own chute up into this little village. I'd say there was maybe 30, 40 homes there, houses. But these,
did you ever see the other guys again?
Yes. We got together with me and the waste gunner that were near. They marched us into another town, and we met the bombardier and my pilot. They got them, and the pilot was injured pretty bad, and the bombardier and the engineer had a very bad, he had a 20 millimeter explode in the turret, upper turret, and he had most of his leg shot out, and eventually they repatriated him. And the pilot landed, and he landed on one foot and threw his whole hip joint out of place. Mm-hmm. And we had to carry him on a stretcher with the Germans, and we had to carry him to a hospital. And they, without any anesthetic or that, they put that. And I was the aid man on board, and I had access to some morphine. Mm-hmm. And I was shooting them with morphine to try to get this pain set off a little bit, and wouldn't help. But we held them down on the floor, a concrete floor, and they popped that hip back in. And he yelled and screamed, and we were so fed up with everything. We were getting on each other's nerves, more or less. You know how it would be. And more or less, I said, oh, keep quiet, you know. But I know what he was going through, and then, well, he's on disability today.
How about, did any of the Germans speak English, or did you just...
Yes, there was a few. The one thing I remember, Doug, on they put us in a barn, and there was a young kid came up. He was, maybe 12 years old, 11, 12 years old, and he came up and he says, American flyers. Yeah, American flyers. He says, I'm speaking English. I says, yeah, you're speaking English. Can you understand me? And we were the first ones that he, first people that spoke, you know, English uh-huh. that he talked to. Uh-huh. So he learned it in school, and oh, he wanted to do things for us, yeah. and the guards wouldn't allow him to. We wanted some matches and some cigarettes, and then, you know, obviously yeah, yeah. kicked him over. But he was real happy that he could speak with well, someone that understood practice. Him, you know. Yeah. So that was, I recall that. But the guards could speak some, but when we went into the prison camp as such, they had into the interrogation units of the prison camp, they had officers that, well, they were fluent in English. Mm-hmm. In fact, I met one, he interrogated me. He said he knew how the railroad from Cleveland through Newcastle to Pittsburgh, and he traveled. He was in the United States. He was educated here, and then went back there and was caught in the war, you know.
Sir.
Yeah.
What was that like going to the camp? Where was the camp, and what do you remember?
Well, we went to what they call a Dulag Luft from Hanover. They shipped us to Frankfurt. That's Frankfurt on the Rhine. They called it a Dulag Luft. It was an interrogation center. And they tried to more or less get everything out of you, that try to break you down. I mean, it wasn't anything real cruel or anything like that. I think 6 or 7 days in solitary. They'd get you out, interrogate you, put you back in, and everyone went through that. And
what did you tell them? What did they
name, rank, and serial number. They asked what group you were from, what kind of bombs are you using, and who's your commanding officer, and I don't know if any, even if you'd have told them some of that, I don't think it would have hurt anything, because there's nothing secret.
Yeah.
But name, rank, and serial number. And I just kept doing the same thing until if you didn't tell them anything, then after 6-7 days, we all met in one big hall, you know, there, and wow, we're all together again. But
any rough stuff? Did they ever try to rough you up or threaten you?
We got roughed up from some civilians when we were there. They marched us. They used to march us right through towns. So we walked a lot. And instead of going out through the outskirts of a town, like I know Frankfurt, they marched us right down through Frankfurt. And I mean, all the rubble, and it was bombed, just a pile of brick. And they marched us right down like the main street, and the civilians would. They'd have umbrellas, and they start hitting us over the head and stuff like that. And they were showing us off, you know, they'd answer us. But, I didn't see anything real cruel other than the food shortage. We went through a lot of lean days. Everyone was on a strict diet then.
What was the solitary like?
It was a room, probably, I'd say 6 or 7 foot wide, and maybe 8 or 9 foot long, with a one door and a window way up, a frosted window, and just a bunk with a straw mattress. Then when you had to go to relieve yourself, you had to flip a flag on the inside, and the guard would see the flag, and then he'd come and get you, and only one could go at a time. Then they kept everyone apart. And then the food they put in, there was a little tray like in the door, and they put the food in there.
What kind of food? What did they give you?
Brown, real brown bread, and mostly for those 7 days, brown bread and a soup, sort of like what I recall, made maybe out of dandelion, like a wedding soup, you know. But there was no meat in it. It was just broth and greens and the bread and water and the
position. Then taking you to the main prison then. What was life like that? Was there a lot of
there? Yeah, I went to from this Dulag Luft to another camp at Gießen, Germany. And this was just more or less a dispatch area, you know, where they congregated all the prisoners and decided where, what other permanent camp he was going to go to. So I spent about a month there. And it wasn't too bad. It was, we had a room with eight guys, and there was not much to do other than maybe play some cards. And
what was a typical day?
Typical day, you get up in the morning, they'd rouse you out, you know. And,
early?
Yeah. Say about 7 o'clock, they'd get you out into the main compound and take roll call. And that would last maybe an hour. And then you'd go back in, and then you'd go to the, get something to eat, get your bread and some oleo, and what they call ersatz coffee. It was just it tastes like burnt wood, you know, water poured over burnt wood. But just spend the day in the room, or if there was an air raid, we had to go into air raid shelters, and then we went to, we'd get back to the mess hall, and then we'd maybe get some type of Red Cross food, you know, Spam or something like that, and some more black bread. And that was more or less a typical day. Then lights out early, and they'd lock the doors, and
were you allowed to get anything in other than the Red Cross, like newspapers or?
No, nothing? No, it was all controlled. And very, very few Red Cross articles. Mm-hmm. In fact, this place was good for us as far as Red Cross parcel, I mean, the food and that. In fact, I didn't see too much after that. From Gießen, we went, we shipped up through Germany into our permanent camp, which was in what they call Barth, it was near Barth, Germany, Pomerania, I think. This was eventually in the Russian zone.
Where are we now? What time period?
We're in. I was shot down in November 22nd, 1944. Now we're looking at. The latter part of 44, the first part of 45.
Okay, around the bulge then.
Well, yes, we get the prisoners in the bulge. And got shipped into Barth, Germany. Now this was, there must have been, I'd say 30,000 Air Corps mm-hmm. prisoners. There was four big compounds in this camp. And I would say maybe close to 5,000-6,000 maybe fires in each compound, and we had a commanding officer in each compound, and then we had an Allied commander of the whole camp. And I don't know if you ever remember, he was an ace. Well, two aces: Lieutenant Colonel Gabreski from Oil City. He was my compound commander, and I knew him personally. And then the whole camp commander was Colonel Zemke. And they were two flying aces and then prisoners. But it was this more or less the repetition of the other camps, but in a larger scale, I'd say. I mean, more people there, and we had barracks that were, they were built on stilts, like, you know, I mean, posts, and where the dogs would be running underneath at night, and then we had 12 prisoners in each room, and we had triple bunk beds. And we had a very efficient organization there. Like we had the fuel committeeman, and we had more or less a cook, and we had the food, the ration of the food out, and we had a person ahead of each one of these in the room itself, and then within the whole barracks we had the organization. Like, it was very efficient.
Cooperate?
Oh yeah, it was good. I mean, you didn't dare to try to go against one of your own buddies, because it would have been too bad.
How about escape? Anybody ever talk about escape or present you with a plan, or you have a plan?
No, there was talk. We used to get a secret news flimsy, they'd call it, about every week that it secretly passed. I don't know, we never questioned it, but it was, we'd get news. I guess they probably had a radio someplace that would get BBC and some bulletins. But I was never, there could have been some plans for escape there, but you know, it was only more or less for select few, maybe some of the old timers and that, but I never heard of any, Doug.
How about when the new guys, as you were in and the new people came in, did you always ask them how the war was going when they came in? Did they inform you as to how we were doing?
Probably the most important time was, you mentioned before, the bulge. About 2 weeks later, you know, after the Battle of the Bulge, they were taken in prisoners. Well, we were like an air corps prison camp, what they called a Stalag Luft. At the time of the bulge, I guess there wasn't enough room for them to go into the other prison camps, and they were bringing them into ours, and oh, they were coming in, and everyone was so darn downhearted, you know, seeing all these people coming in, and they're just the lowest they could be, you know, as far as morale. And we said, oh no, this thing's going to last a long time yet. Uh-huh. And we really thought it was. We were very, very demoralized at that time.
When the as the war was winding down, were you seeing evidence in the camp that there were possibly like food shortages among the Germans, or fuel where they were, it was affecting the camps?
Not really. We there were some bomb strikes nearby, and we had the feeling that things just had a turn, because, you know, we were the greatest, more or less, coining a phrase. But then we had those here reports, those flimsy reports, you know, coming through, and they said it was turning. And we could see a little bit of different attitude as far as the Germans and the guards. And in fact, They just evacuated the whole camp. I mean, as far as the German personnel, toward the end, and we got up one morning, there's no Germans around. The machine gun towers were all vacated, and there's nobody around.
How was that now? Did somebody wake up first and say, there's nobody here, let's go?
Yeah, there's nobody here, but now here's where the organization took part. Now, we were under strict military orders, you know, from our superiors. We had to stay there, and we were in a Russian zone, you know, the predetermined zone, and the Americans were they stopped. They couldn't come any further east. Yeah. And the Germans were coming. We had to wait on the Germans to come up the coast from Stettin and up through the coast of Barth and to evacuate us. And there was a lot of anxieties then. Oh my, What are they going to do with us now? We might be going through the same thing as the Germans put us through. And, well, we got orders from our superiors. We start tearing down the barbed wire fences and the towers, and we made it look less like a prison camp than it was. And we went out, and there was a... We had orders not to go into town because there might be booby traps and stuff. But we did, there was a nice bay came into it. It was a beautiful place other than, you know, what it was used for. And there was a bay coming right down like into camp, and they had the fishing nets there, and there's some boats left, and boy, we really got to fish. We ate a lot of fish there. We ate a lot of horse meat before, and then like that soup I said, maybe some barley, but boy, when we got these fish, well, everyone was building fires outside. We'd make makeshift fires, and we got some tin and that with barbecuing this fish out there. But that was just like a T-bone steak.
I was going to say, it must have been like a smorgasbord.
We really enjoyed that.
So did the Russians liberate you then?
Yeah, they came in, and... It was peaceful, but they told us to, what they say, you obey them, because they were our superiors, you know. And they made us clean the camp up some more. They came in, some of them riding horses. They didn't come in like with tanks and that. It was just the walking troops, and some of the shock troops came in. And... I know our officer said if they see anything they want, you know, just give it to them, and don't fight them in any way. And they negotiated with our.
Sorry, to let the take up comes on there. Okay, what do you remember about the Russians? You know, what kind of emotions? Were you just glad to be free, or did? Were you really concerned?
We were glad to be free, but we were we had some anxious moments because we thought that we were going to get marched out of there, and not knowing where. And in fact, we were told to get ready to go. Just take the clothes on your back, and you know, something to keep warm, and that was it. This was in the latter part of April now. And it wasn't too warm up. We were pretty far north. And in fact, it was more or less across from Sweden, that bay there. And we were all ready. In fact, we got all of the bread and sliced it up and divvied it out. And all the rations, we just shared it all alike. And we waited. In fact, for maybe 4 or 5 days until all the plans were set, and they agreed that they're going to fly some B-17s into the airport at Barth. And
or Americans?
No, B-17. Our plane. Yeah. They agreed that they let our planes come in and evacuate us. So we marched it was about 5 miles into the airstrip there, and we were still dubious until we got into that plane and started heading out, you know. The planes were bombers, but they were stripped down, you know. There was no guns, and we just sat in there. I don't know how many went in each plane, but they evacuated the whole camp, flew us into France then. So,
were you able to get word home? When were you able to?
I sent prisoner of war letters home, and not knowing that they got them or not. In fact, I never heard from my parents until I got back onto Clyde Street after all that time. But they were getting my letters. In fact, we were allowed to send shortwave message, and here the I am a prisoner of war in Germany. I am okay, or, you know, something like that. And it was received, they had monitoring stations here in the United States, and then at that time, when we were in camp, we gave our name and address. Everyone did. It was no name, rank, and serial number as such, you know. I mean, you couldn't give any secret information if you knew it, but the home. And Mom got the message from the woman in New Jersey that she had received my message and relaying it to her. And they already got notified that I was a prisoner of war, but then this came later on. And they got all my letters, and but I never got anything from home. I never received a letter or postcard or package or anything like that.
When you went to France, then how did everything wind? The war was over.
The war was over.
How did it wind down for you then?
Well, when we got to France, first thing they did was march us into a delousing station, they call it. we stripped down, and they had these big shower rooms, you know, and strip down out there, and they give you a big bar of this GI soap, you know, GI soap, Doug, yeah. The brown soap, P&G, wow. Like P&G soap, yeah. And get in there, and maybe 20, 30 guys at a time, and scrub down and delouse.
That was it.
And line up, back into the army routine again, line up and wait, and we spent the day there in tents, then we got shipped to Camp Lucky Strike. They named all these camps. I don't know if you knew that.
Mm-hmm.
They had Camp Lucky Strike, Camp Chesterfield, all named after Camp Philip Morris.
In France.
Okay. 10 cities. I mean, as far as you could see, it was tents. And it was just made for the returning POWs.
Oh.
And they had these outside these field kitchens, you know, they had, with the steam cookers and that. And that's the way we lived there until we had enough boats or ships to take us back. And we went into, I think it was Reims, France, and they marched us, took us into Reims, into the harbor there, and we got on the boats and come back.
What did you come back on? Did you come back on one of the big ocean liners? Or?
No, it wasn't the big one. In fact, I was, I'd call it fortunate. I had an injury, and they were treating me on, and I was in a hospital unit on this boat, and it was heaven in there, you know. They took care of us, I thought I was in heaven compared to what I went through. And we got into that hospital unit on the boat, and I spent the time coming back on in the hospital.
Then, when you were going home, did you know, was that you were being discharged, or were you going to get back into the, were you going to still be in the Army for a while, or how did they work that for you?
Well, I thought maybe I got discharged real quick because of the point system. Mm-hmm. They had a point system. Well, we got back, we landed in Newport News, and then we were taken to Fort Dix. And then they, more or less a debriefing thing, you know, and try to get your records straightened mm-hmm. up. And then they gave me a 60-day leave, and I come in from Fort Dix on a bus, no, to Philadelphia, and then to Pittsburgh on a bus, and from Pittsburgh I got the train into Mahoningtown, and when I got into Mahoningtown I called up my mother and dad.
Oh, they didn't know anything.
They didn't
it.
Know nothing, and I didn't know if anyone was passed on or what,
mm-hmm.
and I said, I'm in Mahoningtown.
What was that like?
Andy, he was just a young whippersnapper. He come down with the car. My dad and mom didn't come down. He come down, and I'm waiting there in the train station in Mahoney. You know that overpass there? I think it was PNLE, wasn't it?
Either that or, I don't know.
Yeah, right in Mahoney.
Yeah.
I think it was. So Andy come in, and he looked like, well, he grew up like, you know, probably grew a foot since I saw him last. First thing he said, Siri, so you want to drive? First thing he said, I says, no. I says, you drive. And come home, and I asked him everything, you know, coming up from Mahoney Town to Bessemer, about the family and all. And that was it.
How about when you got home? Anything special, party?
No, they wanted to do everything for me, you know. They wanted to fix me everything to eat, and but I couldn't eat. I had a shrunken stomach, mm-hmm. and I mean, I had a big appetite, but there was no room for it. I know mom and dad, they wanted to give me everything, you know. I mean, I can't do it now, yeah. And it was a good reunion.
How about the Army then? Did you go back after the 60 days to finish up? Or?
I had to go back. I ended up where I started from, in Miami again. They gave me a 90-day leave in Miami. Miami Beach, beautiful. And if we were, I wasn't married, and I was going with my to be wife then. And in fact, a lot of the guys that married when they got home, and they went down, it was the 90 days on the government.
Yeah.
Oh, it was terrific. I mean, there was golfing, deep sea fishing, everything furnished, meals. The lodging in the hotel and all for 90 days. So this was like, I went through a lot of physicals there. I had dysentery real bad in Germany, and they were following this through. And after the 90 days, I got this, the records were all fouled up. And I had, you know, abundant points, but then I ended up in the Lockburn Air Base in Columbus. They assigned me to an office there, working for the officers club. So it was pretty nice. They were paying me flight pay, base pay plus flight pay for working for the officers. So it wasn't too bad, but I'm getting anxious, you know. Finally, the records got straightened up, and they put me on a bus, and I went down to Patterson Field in Dayton, and that's where I was separated. Well, I went into the hospital there for a couple of weeks and got some things taken care of, and then I got discharged from there. Went back to Columbus and shed all my Army clothes. I had a little satchel. I went and bought a new suit, shirt and tie and shoes and a nice camel tan. coat. This was in my like November now, you know, and I come home that way. I walked down the street, and I had what I had. My Army gear was in this little like a gym bag, mm-hmm. and I'm walking down the street, you know, a civilian.
Then from there, back to the plant.
Well, I took some time off. November, December, January, February. I think I went back to the plant in March. Well, my time was still accumulated, and from there, got married in 45, raised four kids.
when you started back to work, what was the mood of the town compared to what it was like at the beginning when you left?
Well,
were vets special, I think?
Well, not necessarily. Well, maybe more than I'd say when the Vietnam vet. I really pity those guys. I mean, they took a beating. We were more or less. Well, it was some time after I got discharged, and I got back, and the mood things were winding down, you know, as far as the world. Let's get back to work and get married
start all over
again. There was no big celebrations or anything like that.
Okay. Anything that we left out that you want to add? Anything you remember that...
No.
Was the service good for you? Other than the...
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I wouldn't have traded it for... Well, like they say, I wouldn't go through it for a million, and I wouldn't exchange it for $1 million, you know. I met a lot of friends in there, and in fact, probably I was closer to some of those, like in my crew, than with some people in town here, maybe, you know. And other than that, Doug, it's been a long time. May 4th is going to be 40 years now for me that I was liberated. 1945.
Does that feel like yesterday?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I always said, well, when I come home on that day, I said, I wouldn't remember November 44, but I said, I'll remember it, but not celebrate. But May and from 45, I said, I'm going to celebrate, but I never did.
Just glad.
I never did.
When you were in the POW camp, what did you miss about home? Was there something that...
Not knowing what tomorrow was going to be, Doug. It was, a lot of times, it was very touchy. In fact, we were put in boxcars. Well, you probably saw the Holocaust, and you see these here little cattle cars.
Right.
I traveled from Giessen to Barth in one of them. It took us around 4 or 5 days. We had four or five guards on half of the car and maybe 20 or 25 prisoners on the other half.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then we'd go into maybe the outskirts of some town or maybe a city, and there'd be air raid sirens blowing, and the guards would jump out and lock the door, and we were there, and we could hear the whoop, you know, the car jumped because the bombs hitting, and oh, golly. And we were laying on straw, and boy, you didn't hear any straw crack.
No.
And not knowing maybe what tomorrow, if there was going to be a tomorrow in some of those days, and hunger. I mean, I knew what hunger was, and I never was hungry after that.
No.
People, you know, you say, I'm hungry. You're not hungry, no. He said, boy, am I hungry. But I try to explain to, you know, later on, I said, no, that, you're not hungry, you know. you just feel like you want something to eat.
Yeah.
But real hunger, I knew what real hunger was. Most of the guys there were down to maybe... Instead of weighing 170 or 165, they were down like 130, 125. And I think I was about 120 pounds.
Did you ever have a reunion? Any of the guys?
No,
my
pilot lives up here at Brookfield.
Oh.
And we keep in touch and visit each other. But Christmas cards and stuff like that. Then, we planned a reunion. I know my the engineer that I told you got repatriated. He called me up. He's from Minden, Louisiana, and we were talking about visiting. And I don't know, everybody has their own, you know, their own ways, and it's hard to get together after a while. Say after 40 years.
Yeah.
In fact, it's hard to get the family together. You know.
Hard enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it'd be nice to get together.
Okay. Anything else that you can remember?
It's about all that I see.
That's good. Okay. Thank you.